We apologize for this brief interruption in the show. As many of you likely know, the Higher Standard Podcast is officially sponsored by Transcend Company. Transcend has been my longtime provider for both testosterone and peptide therapies. But they offer so much more. Whether you're interested in health, wellness, or longevity, it all begins with you getting your blood work done. A lab draw will help you get the numbers and establish your baseline. You can go to transcendcompany.com/THSP. That's transcendcompany.com/THSP. Or you can click the link in the show notes on any streaming platform and on YouTube. Fill out your information and one of the representatives will contact you to get your journey started today. Now back to the show.
And all the recording lights are on.
I'm going to find out the hard way.
We always find out the hard way. That's what we do. What do you mean?
Luckily, because we've managed to only fuck that up so few times, even when Rune fucked it up, that
we had a backup plan.
We had a backup plan. That's the beauty in the system we have set up. The redundancy is fucking amazing.
I remember back in the day, there was a popular quote going around by Will Smith saying there's no need for a plan B because it distracts from plan A. But you had
no,
a plan B.
I definitely need a plan B.
Yeah, I'm always having a plan B kind of guy.
I haven't lived without a plan B ever, and I don't plan on starting now.
That's like some like influencer type shit. Like, oh, that sounds so good. Repost it.
Yeah. You know, man, I'm one double up away from being a billionaire, bro.
One double up.
The shit that you see on social media. There's a couple guys making the rounds with just their ostentatious shit about being like, you know, I know everybody's aiming for millionaire.
Right.
But see, to show you what level I'm on, I'm aiming for billionaire.
Have to. I mean,
I'm like, really?
You're selling yourself short if you're not.
And then when somebody who's interviewing them, who's equally stupid, tries to call them out on it, they go, no, let me explain to you inflation.
Right.
Let me learn you some stuff, son. Okay?
Let me teach you the math.
So basically, $1 million today is worth about $250,000 in about 45 years from now. Right. So what I'm doing is I'm preparing mentally for the place that you're going to have to be in 20 years from now.
I mean, that's all it is.
That's just compound interest, baby.
Exactly. Well, we got a good episode for everybody today. Let's get right into it. So something that Chris and I, we've been seeing has been making the rounds across all social media platforms is that there's a wealth killer. And everyone, every financial guru and their mama are making videos about.
I'm not going to lie. When you first started bringing this up to me, I had no idea the fuck you're talking about.
Really? Oh, my God. Literally, just search number one wealth killer. You'll see every financial guru talking about it. And we thought that, okay, so maybe there's something here that we need to address. So usually when thinking about the source of your financial problems, Chris and I and the people that we speak to rarely. Shout out, Odun.
You know.
You'll find out in a little bit why we're saying that. We rarely hear people admit to their car payment being something that they subject themselves to that's causing their financial problems. So what does this all boil down to? We have your household expenses. Household expenses are things that make up, you know, your monthly expenses every month. You got your housing, whether that's your mortgage payment or the rent that you're paying. You got utilities. That doesn't fluctuate too much. You got your electricity, gas, water, trash removal. Right. And you got groceries. That includes food, dining out with your friends, maybe grabbing some drinks if that's what you like to partake in. And then a big one that really affects a lot of people is transportation. And the thing that bothers us the most is what society has done to everyone. Come on, man.
Come on, man. It's called live streaming.
Live streaming. What society has done to paint people out as successful as someone having a really nice car. And I think that we need to be the ones on the front lines here, making it cool again to talk about being financially responsible, to not subject yourself to a high car payment.
Oh, God damn it. There's like rabbit holes I can go down with this that's going to take all night long. How much time do we have for tonight's show?
I'm on record, I want to say I am guilty of making these mistakes. So if I can prevent one person.
Shit. I am so guilty of making these mistakes in the most ostentatious, stupid-ass ways.
And here's the beauty behind this conversation that you're about to listen to between two people. I mean, it's no secret. Chris is in a much different financial position than someone like me.
Not anymore. I'm poor.
But you got to understand, I remember when my wife and I, when we first got married, I said, look, I'm not sure how much money we will be making down the road in the future. But if we can just make sure we don't make any financial missteps, we'll be just fine. And then what did I do? Messed around and went and bought myself a brand new Jeep just because I needed to scratch that itch of having my quote unquote dream car. It's not a fancy car.
I don't think that was as bad as you make it out to be, man.
No, it's not. But here's the problem. I didn't need it at the time.
We you want to talk stupid? I'll give you stupid.
We had a paid off. We had a paid off Honda Civic. Listen to this. Okay. This is now we're going back to the listener that says Saeed never likes to share any personal stories about it.
Oh, is this a rare moment where you share some personal shit?
Personal stuff that made that I'm
going to sit right up for this shit. Go ahead. I'm all ears.
I'm willing to showcase my stupidity. Okay. We had a paid off Honda Civic. We had just gotten a Ford Explorer at the time for my wife to have a bigger car for the kids. Mm. Okay, so the kids could be safe in a car. That's something that everyone wants, right? We also had a paid off Honda Civic. After a couple of years, now we're expecting our second kid. And I was like, you know, I'm handling all the drop offs because my wife has to get to work super early. You know, I need a big car too. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I'm trying to rationalize to myself that I should be getting a newer car, a little bit more safer of a car. A Jeep is not any safer.
And anecdotally, the backseat of a Jeep is surprisingly small.
It's really small, and it's not a safe car. There's no side airbags. I'm literally talking myself into why I deserve this car. I work hard. I deserve this. This is for someone to say my dream car is a brand new Jeep. I mean, usually you think of something like a flashy car, right? For me, I was never into the Mercedes-Benzes or the BMWs or anything. Don't get me wrong. I think they're really nice cars. But for me personally, I just wanted to have like a brand new Jeep. To me, that was the coolest car out there. Sure enough, even though my car payment now, when you look back at it and you compare it to today's standards, my car payment was only at $500. And it was still within the, you know, the ratio that they recommend for as far as what your income is. I didn't need to do that to myself. I could have taken that money. I had a paid off car. I could have invested it. And we'll get into some examples shortly as to how much money I could have made over that time period.
Man, let's see. I got a 745 i, top of the line, black, black on black BMW.
How old are you?
I was in my like mid-20s. You were there. I think it was mid-20s, right?
Right.
And then I bought it used. So in that one, I wasn't totally stupid. Like, I got it used, right? But then I went and played fuck around and find out. I put 22-inch wheels on it, tires, the whole thing. And big, deep dish. I think there was like 5.5 or 6-inch rims in the back. Problem is, as aesthetically cool as that was, like every time you hit a pothole driving to Los Angeles, like there goes your wheel.
Right.
Like you need a new rim.
Yeah, and you purchased it. You didn't lease it, right?
I purchased that one, but that one bit me in the ass because ultimately the transmission went out in that one. Right? I bought it certified pre-owned, so I wasn't totally stupid on how I bought it. Transmission went out, and I'll never forget the day that it went out. I was supposed to meet a bunch of friends back at my then apartment, right? I started buying some real estate, but I still lived in a 580 square foot junior one bedroom apartment. Basically, it was like a studio apartment, but it had a wall for a bedroom, right? And I'm supposed to meet all these people at my house. We're supposed to go out to Laguna Beach afterward. My dad, I love my dad to death. This is not a knock on him, but this is just the truth, okay? He says, hey, you're making all this money now. He started to see how much money I was making because he helped me with some loan stuff because I didn't want to do it through my own bank. And I just didn't want to, I didn't have time to mess with it. So I leveraged him to do it for me. My dad's a broker in the space. And he's like, you deserve like a nice car. So I drove the car limping along to Irvine BMW, and then I pulled the wires from the battery, right, so that they couldn't test drive it because they knew they would tell me there's a transmission issue because a different BMW dealership told me that I needed a new transmission, and it was several thousand dollars, several, ridiculous amount of money. One thing leads to another. I'm supposed to meet with some friends at my house. It's Halloween night. I'm running late. I wind up with a 745 Li. Top of the line, long wheelbase, brand new model, 7 Series that I leased. And I'd always been, in underwriting, not a proponent of leasing cars because I knew that going over mileage was just kind of a thing you do. That the benefits of a lease really inure to somebody who owns a company. If you own a company and your CPA tells you, not you whimsically trying to find out a way to make this shit happen, don't be that person. Social media is all about, if you get a truck that's in the 6,000-pound bracket or more, it'll qualify for this discount or that discount. And the reality is, whether you like it or not, that's probably not going to be you. The sad, unfortunate situation for most people is that when you get to a position in life where you have a CPA and you're making enough money for this, your CPA will call you up one day and say, hey, you should do this because you can write off the difference and it'll save you some money. Now, the words saving you some money is kind of contextual. You can either pay the money to the government or you can do something for yourself, but either way, the money is not going to be in your pocket.
There you go.
You just get the benefit of something as opposed to just writing a check to the government.
Right.
That being said, that car cost me a tremendous amount of money. I was way over on mileage. I was, you know, I'd kept the maintenance there. At the end of the lease, I had nothing. I had a residual buyout that didn't make any sense. And I was incredibly frustrated with it.
And that, yeah, that's the problem, right, with leasing, right? So for the listeners out there that maybe have never leased a car or are thinking about leasing a car and don't know some of the struggles that go with it, they limit you to how many miles you can drive mm-hmm. every year and by the time you return the car. And if you go over that mileage, they could charge you anywhere from 10 cents for every mile you're over or sometimes up to 50 cents, right?
Yeah, and keep in mind, too, if there's beyond like your normal like wear and tear on the vehicle, you're responsible for that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Something happens while you're driving it, like that's on you.
Right.
And a lot of people wind up in a situation at the end of the lease where they feel compelled to buy out the car and keep the car because they don't want to pay whatever the cost would be to turn it in and lose everything.
Right. And then you're still in that scenario where if you would have just bought the car outright, you would have saved money on the deal and you're now paying more for the car.
100%. And I will say, look, like I get the idea that you pay have a lower payment. So people try to argue that, oh, this cash flow is going to help me over time because I'm paying less money every single month than I otherwise would. Or you can just get less high end of a car. But the fact of the matter is, and this is the cold, hard truth, almost all vehicles, not all of them, but almost all of them are depreciating assets. You really shouldn't be putting a whole lot of money into depreciating assets until you've built kind of the core concepts we talk about on the show, which includes a 6-month reserve, right? 6-month liquidity and reserve. It includes a retirement account that you're consistently investing into.
Credit card payments. Credit cards should be completely paid off.
Credit cards you pay off at the end of every single month. And at that point in time, when you start to look at your investment structure and what you're doing, if you're on course and you're on target and you feel like spoiling yourself, do that. I made some mistakes along the way, 100%. My next car after the 7 Series, just anecdotally, you know what it was? It's a Jeep.
It's a Jeep. I was there.
Yeah, and let me tell you, this story is interesting because it really brought into my mind the frame of why you buy a car, like frame of reference. Shortly before I went on a business trip to Hawaii, an older coworker, she saw my car. She said, "Why do you drive an old man car?" And I was like, "I don't, fuck you talking about? I don't drive an old man car.
I make this shit hip.
Like, that thing's dope."
Well, which one?
That was the White 7 Series.
The White 7? That's not an old man car, man. All the rappers got it.
Like, that was the thing, man. It was fully equipped. Long wheelbase, too. Plenty of room to, like sit back in the back seat. You know, I mean, I never sat back there, but I hear good things. But, and then, as I said that day, in the parking lot came the oldest employee that we have in the bank, Roger. Shout out to him. Fucking stud. Love Roger.
Right.
He got the exact same car a couple weeks later. Same wheelbase, same. And Roger's balling. Like, he makes money look like it's just falling off like trees. Like, here's $1,000 for me.
He's the kind of gentleman where you look at and you think to yourself, that guy's got money. Like, you already know.
If Tom Cruise from Risky Business grew up, it would be Roger.
Wow. Yeah. Solid reference.
Bro, Roger was 80 years old, and we were at a hip bar that just opened up in Newport, and I'm sitting there with my wife, and it's packed, like no standing room only.
Yeah.
And we're at the front of the bar. I feel this tap on my shoulder, and it's like, "Hey, young man." Like, right at the front, I'm like, come on, bro.
That delivery, too?
You can't be that cool, man.
Right.
In any event, yeah. So he rolls up in that, and I'm like, shit, it's an old man car. So that was my premise. I was still like, I still love the car, all the features, all the amazing things. But then I go to this trip to Hawaii, right? I'm in Hawaii and I rented a Jeep. Not because like I picked one out, just because like I rented a car. They have like a fleet of Jeeps there. They just gave me a Jeep.
Yeah.
And, you know, during after work hours, I'm rolling around going on all these hikes. And I remember looking out the top, which is off, and I'm going up to like Cocoa Head or Diamond Head or something like that. And it's this beautiful day. And I'm looking out the sunroof going like, why don't I live in? I live next to Laguna Beach. Like, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's basically a mini Hawaii.
This makes all the sense.
Like, why don't I have one of these? Like, what am I doing wrong?
Right.
Flew back, came back within like a month and a half. I had a Jeep.
Yeah. For me, it was growing up. I remember my dad's a mechanic, and he loves fixing up cars. He loves fixing up old cars. Loves working on all kinds of cars. And I always remember asking him all the time, like, if you could have one car, what would it be? And he always said he wanted a Jeep. And I think it was a play on him saying he loved the Jeep so much that naturally it just like got embedded in my head that, oh, you love this too. And after driving it, you realize it's just such a fun car to drive.
I've got an anecdotal story here, which again, highlights. So I've highlighted the fact that experiences should matter more than the experience of somebody seeing you in it, the joy of driving it should matter more.
Yeah.
I do have an anecdotal story, which I hesitate to share, but I'm going to do this because I think there's value in it. Okay. All right. So there was a period where I had the Jeep and I had the 7 Series at the same time. I had to turn the 7 Series in. And I bought the Jeep long before it was time to turn in the 7 Series, so I kind of drove them like whenever, but I pretty much drove the Jeep all the time after that. And I drove to LA to go on a date, and the date was with a playmate. Mm. And she was very well known and, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. A friend of mine set us up this date. And we were going to what was then the hottest restaurant in LA, which I had been to several times for business, right? When we were starting the company, I'd spent a lot more time up in LA, meeting people, clients, stuff like that. And I was kind of helping oversee sales for a little bit. So I'll never forget when she came out and saw the Jeep. I mean, it was a bone stock Jeep at the time. And I had big plans. I wanted to be very modified, all this stuff.
Right.
The look I got when she came out, I was like, huh. And I wonder what would have happened differently. We never went on another date. Like, it was just that.
Right.
Right? But we went to the restaurant, and she was, because she saw the car, and she assumed that I hadn't gone to a restaurant like this frequently or that I hadn't been there, she assumed that nobody knew me. Mm. So we get to this restaurant, and she's like, you know, you can get this here, you can get that here. And I didn't say anything. I was like, all right, cool, you know, whatever. She's like, I'll introduce you to, you know, blah, 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 these people are... The guy comes over to the table, puts down my Manhattan on the table. Chris, good to see you. It's been a couple of days. How you been? Blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, hey, what's up to her?
Oh, geez.
And it was like this like weird like paradigm shift in the conversation in the night. But I'd already decided when we walked in, like we were not going on it. Like,
yeah,
that was it.
See, and they, lucky for you, you had the confidence and the experience to know, like, I need to avoid this. But a lot of people, I think, are so afraid of dealing with that kind of experience that they rather just pony up the money, pay the... You know, right now you're seeing a lot of people with $1,000 monthly car payments, and you're like, what are you doing, man?
Dude, my sister, who never listens to the show, has a $1,600 a month Mercedes-Benz payment.
Makes absolutely no sense.
Mind you, I have an $1,100 Rivian payment right now, which I'm only carrying for a short period of time because you've listened to the episode we did just before this, episode 220, where we talked about credit. One of the things I like to do is put installment loans on my credit report and pay them down a little bit over time. I typically pay them off early, so about a year, year and a half from now, I'll just pay it all off in cash.
Right.
But I like to have that trade line because, and I also have it under my wife's name, so it helps build her credit in addition to mine as well.
Right. And typically speaking, the rule of thumb that a lot of people like to live by, if you aren't in that type of position to where you can do that and you are financing a car, make sure that you are buying a car and you're putting it on a plan where you're paying it off within no later than 4 years. That's the rule of thumb that I've always heard. If you can get that down to 3 years, even better, right? Because you never want to be in a position to where you're underwater, where you owe more on the car than it's actually worth. Now, we've all heard that driving a car off the lot immediately loses 10% of its value right when you turn on. You put the key in, you drive off, or I mean, now maybe all cars are push to start. Take the car off the lot, 10% down. But typically on average, what you'll see is values of cars will come down 20 to 30% within the first year.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a concept I think most people really don't understand, especially when you can get a certified pre-owned vehicle from most dealerships. Mm-hmm. You get a warranty, you get powertrain coverage, you get a vehicle that you know is going to work for a, you know, prescribed period of time under the warranty. Why not do that? Somebody else already taking the depreciation hit.
Right.
You're getting it for lower than market, especially some vehicles like... The Jeeps for a long period of time held their value. The resale value was one of the highest resale values
in
the secondary
yeah.
market. But a lot of Mercedes-Benzes, BMWs, these things truly depreciate the second you drive them off a lot, and it's pretty significant. You can have somebody else take that depreciation hit, buy it a year or two used. Mm. Sure, you don't know how it was used the entire time that somebody else drove it. But odds are, if they're giving you a certified pre-owned warranty, it wouldn't be a problem for you anyway.
It shouldn't be a problem anyways, exactly. And another factor that you have to take into consideration that When you're there, they get you looking at all the bells and whistles, right? But if you're looking to buy a car, you got to think of the maintenance factor on these cars. This is a valuable lesson I learned early from my dad. One of the benefits of my dad being a mechanic was a lot of times people, if they had really bad like issues with their car and they didn't want to pay for it or didn't want to deal with it, he would buy it off them and then he could fix it up and then he would ask like, you could have it or we could resell it, right? And I'll never forget, I had my first car was a Honda Civic. And then the very next car that this happened, he could have upgraded me to a little bit older of a Lexus GS. Mm. Big upgrade for a kid, right? Yeah, yeah. Early 20s. I said, oh, yeah, sign me up. He's like, oh, okay, just know that $300 you typically pay to replace all your tires, just turned into over $1,000, or maybe closer to $2,000. And I was like, okay, cool, never mind. I'm just going to stick to my Honda Civic. Dude, and that's just tires.
I just replaced Joanna's tires today for the Tesla. And it was, and she doesn't have like the big upgraded wheels. She has like the standard wheels that came on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was $2,100 for four tires.
Right.
Yeah, today. Plus $170 to fix like the glove box issue. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, like, man, like it's so wild how much some of this stuff costs. But when I look at the Tesla and cars like that, which I think if I were a kid and I want to get a new car, I don't know that I'd get like an EV used. The technology is a little bit too new for that. But if I were to get a new car, especially with the tax rebates and stuff like that you can get with a Tesla, why wouldn't you get like a Tesla Model Y? Like to me, a Model Y is such a good, if you can afford it, right? That's a good, like, healthy option where you get a good blend of technology, you get a decent amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
There is no maintenance on it other than windshield wiper fluid and literally changing tires. Like, that's it.
Right.
So.
And then, I mean, at some point in time, you will have to replace the battery, which basically makes it a wash for all the maintenance
you're
not
going to keep it long enough to where that's a problem for you.
You're probably not, yeah. Right? Well, they haven't been around long enough to know, but maybe we get into some of these terms on these loans because I know typically what you see when you go to the dealership or if you get private financing or through a bank somewhere nearby, which you should definitely explore your options. You know, the financing team over at the dealership is going to charge you an arm and a leg. You get either 24 months, 36 months, 48 months.
The only time you should go through a dealership, really, is there's a couple different versions of it. So if you went to like Rivian, for example, Rivian's really just JP Morgan Chase.
Okay.
But here's the way I look at it is once you get large enough, you're going to have a private money account with your bank like Chase or Wells. Like I have a PMA account with Wells, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll go to their private client financing to get a little bit better pricing. But before I had all that, when I was younger, what I did is I'd go to the dealership. What's your dealership financing terms? I'd go to my bank. What's your financing terms for a new car, a used car? I'd see if I belonged to a credit union. Back in the day, I belonged to Schools First, and the credit union's pricing almost always won out.
The best.
But there was an instance where the dealer was always a good idea, is there was when dealerships got to a point they're desperate, and it still happens in cycles, when they give you 0% or close to 0% financing, like, just take that.
Right.
You're not going to get better than that. If it's super low like that, then take it. And obviously, that's not the rate environment we're in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are getting 6%, 7% interest rates right now, which, you know, I get it, but.
I mean, no, you're seeing somewhere 8%. In some cases.
Yeah, it was subprime stuff, I think, 8%. I think right now you're still, if you're still prime, you're 720 and above in a FICO score range, you should probably be in the 6 to 7 range.
Yeah, hopefully you can get that, definitely. But, but you're starting to see even longer terms, and that's what they get you to do, right? When you go to these car dealerships, what they try to get you to focus on is the monthly payment. Can you live with this payment, right? And they keep stretching out the term of the loan, right? You'll see some loan terms as much as 84 months, right?
Yeah.
And we've even started to see 10-year loans on some of these cars now.
Oh, dude, yeah, no.
And it's, you're like,
it's
this
wild to me.
And that, absolutely not. Like we said, it should be typically, you know, no later than 4 years before you pay it off. Hopefully you can get that under 3.
I think the Rivian's 60 months, but I typically pay them off in about a year, year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So here's the kind of the barometer that I've always used as I've gotten older, is I look to my mortgage or rent payment, right? I should not be spending as much or more than my mortgage or rent payment.
Oh, no way.
Right?
Yeah.
But again, you look at my little sister, she's paying $1,600 a month. If you got a one bedroom someplace, I guarantee you it's going to be close to, if not more than that.
I guess, yeah. It really depends where you live regionally.
It does depend where you live regionally. But it's a good, your mortgage or rent should be your highest cost. Now, if you're getting a sweetheart deal or you're in some situation where you've got roommates and you can bring that cost down because you've house hacked, all good.
Right.
But whatever market is for that, whatever it is your living situation should be, that should be kind of your barometer for am I spending too much on a car or not, given how much you make. And here's the problem is people start going, well, Chris, I make $200,000-$300,000 a year. I can afford more. Good for you. But should you afford more?
Right, exactly. I mean, you could literally take that money, extra money, and what you could do is invest. So back to that example early on when I said we had a paid off Honda Civic when we had kids, and I didn't need a new car. If we were to get a new car today, the average car payment on a new car today is $738 currently today.
That's the average?
For a new car.
Wow.
A lot,
that's
right?
That's a lot, yeah.
That's a lot. So let's just say I didn't need a new car. I had a Honda Civic that I could have ran it to the wheels fell off, you know, 200,000 miles easily, right? If I had just taken that $738 and invested it and got a 7% return, which is very conservative, right? Yeah. Over the long term, right?
Last time you went viral, people very much argued over the 10% number.
I know, exactly. But investing in the stock market over the long term could get you anywhere between 7 to 10%. Now we're saying, you know, 7% because that's how much your interest rate on your car loan would be, right? You'd be contributing $48,000 over that time frame, over 5.5 years. Interest you would have gained is $10,000. You would have been walking away with $58,000. Right? If I'd have just stuck to, and for someone like me that's not in the same financial position as someone like you, $58,000 means a whole lot more to someone like me.
Why are you doing the flex thing?
You
can't do the reverse flex. You can't do that.
It's the like I'm the guy that's wearing the long sleeve to the gym.
That's
like I'm very humble.
First of all, I wear long sleeves to the gym because I don't fall. I know it. Little hack.
You want the dopamine release. You like to sweat more. It gives you more dopamine.
No, I do like that. But there's another reason. I got an ulterior motive. And I got that from that kid, Sam Sulik, who's all over social media right now.
Yeah.
He has a great short clip on it. And the sad part is like this guy doesn't even realize the stuff that he's spitting is like 50-year-old game.
Oh, okay.
Like,
really?
He has like a different... I hated him. Like I was a hater a lot when I saw him because this kid's all roided out. Like he's clearly big. He has some bad skin issues and he got it all worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, his physique is amazing. Number two, his bodybuilding skill set for his age is impressive. But his mindset around the stuff is honestly in some ways more mature than people I've ever experienced, even myself by far.
Really? What about it?
So he was saying that he doesn't wear like fitted tight clothing to the gym. This guy is jacked.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And he was just, you know, he does this on camera talking solo. And he goes, the reason why I don't do it is like there's a massive amount of body dysmorphia. And the problem is for a lot of people who are in otherwise great shape is you'll go to the gym and you'll go to the gym frequently, you know, 3, 4, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're working out, you see you in the mirror with gym lighting, down lighting, pumped up.
Those mirrors.
Doing bicep mind curls, games on whatever. People, dude. He's like, you're going to get a different visual of your body. But when you wake up in the morning and you're flat, you don't have that down lighting and... You know, you're not pumped up. You don't have that pump going.
Damn, that's experience right there.
He goes, you're gonna look at your body and you're gonna feel bad about the way you look. And he's like, there's some people who say, okay, great, it's gonna make me go to the gym more.
Mm-hmm.
There's other people who are gonna see the wrong person in the mirror most of the time. He's like, think about it. If you train hard, 2-3 hours max a day, you should be training in front of a mirror in the gym. You still got 21 other hours in the day,
yeah,
where you should be feeling good about the way you look and you don't.
Yeah, if perception starts to warp your reality.
So it's such an interesting... So I made it a point since hearing that, like when I go to the gym, unless I'm doing something where I know I'm going to work out like super hard, I'm just going to be hot as shit.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a hoodie. I'm wearing like pants. Like I'm just doing my thing quietly.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, in a nutshell, real quick, if you were to recommend somebody buy or lease, what would you say?
Wow, you try to go right back in.
I'm going to try and wrap it up.
That was a questionable swerve. You just... well... I would say, unless you have a CPA telling you that you actually get a financial benefit from leasing is the wrong choice for the overwhelming majority of the population. I'm sure someone's going to see this and be like, hey, man, leases are amazing. Let me tell you why. Okay, great. Good for you. For the majority of the population, not good. And despite popular belief, not everybody out there should be driving Lambos and Ferraris. Matter of fact, most people should not. And let me just give you some interesting tidbits about exotics and all the stuff that you see, that, you know, make the wet dreams on the internet come true. They are not very comfortable to be driving in every single day. Sorry, they're not.
Right.
Exotics are not comfortable. The maintenance and upkeep, they're incredible. You shouldn't be driving an exotic every single day because you're depreciating the shit out of a very expensive vehicle. You're taking more depreciation. And when you go places, it's another thing to worry about. I have friends who all have exotics who now carry weapons in their cars. And I'm like, I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, exactly. Jeez,
there are a lot of real life implications and challenges to being that visually wealthy that people, I think, don't think about when they aspire to have certain things.
Yeah.
You can have a Lambo, Ferrari, all those things, but the reality for most people who have them is they drive a normal car most days of the week.
Yeah, it's true.
So, look, aspire to have a normal, good driving vehicle. Aspire to have something within your financial range where you can make all the investments we talk about in the show, and certainly leasing for the majority of the population, not the way to go.
Right. I would say get a car that's going to last you a long time, that's not very flashy, low maintenance. And by low maintenance, I mean you're not getting, you know, some expensive tires on there. You know the parts to the car are relatively cheap compared to most, right? And you're going to keep it until the wheels fall off, because at the end of the day, buying in the long term will be cheaper than you leasing.
The only reason I sold the Jeep, well, two reasons. Number one, it wasn't retaining water anymore. It was becoming a bit of an issue because I modified it too much. I'm really against modifying daily drivers now. Mm-hmm. It's not my thing anymore. And number two, I just ran out of space. I've got too many cars.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
But otherwise, I wouldn't have done that. So, welcome back to the number one financial literacy podcast in the world. Sitting next to me, my partner in time, the one and only Syed Omar, everybody.
Thank you, my man. Sitting next to me on my left is my partner in crime, Chris Nahibi. Welcome back to the show, everybody.
And not behind the ones and twos tonight is the man with the stinky pinky.
The stinky pinky? Means so many different things.
Arun's daughter, unfortunately, has pink eye, and it is highly contagious. So rather than risk us getting pink eye, we decided that we would defame him publicly while him being at home and being a good dad.
Yeah, yeah. So we miss him in the studio tonight. But if you're listening to this podcast, whether that's on Apple or Spotify, please do us a favor and go and leave us an honest 5-star review. It really does a lot for the show, and it means a lot to each and every single one of us. If you're watching this on YouTube, please make sure you subscribe, hit that like button, ring that notification bell. Let's try to get that like button to as many people as possible, get this episode to as many people as possible. Do all the moist, goody-good sassafras.
A little loose in the end there. A little loose.
Keeping it loose for Stinky Pinky.
Yeah. It's really hard to transition from Stinky Pinky. So I have been complaining about the Bureau of Labor Statistics job numbers for quite some time. And for those of you who've been listening to the show, listen to me, bitch, I owe you an explanation. And we thought this would be no better show than this one to really break down the information and get into why the numbers have been, frankly, so criticized by us, what you should think about what you were going to be told, and frankly, how that may or may not impact your belief in what you're hearing in the news. And then, obviously, we'll dip our toes into, politically speaking, what this could be for and why it could be happening. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to unpack, so strap on your seatbelts. And let's start off with a Yahoo Finance article titled, February Jobs Report, U.S. Economy Adds 275,000 Jobs, Unemployment Rate Hits 3.9%.
Wow.
So it sounds good, right?
Yeah. Mixed emotions about this report.
Why is that?
So, I mean, the added jobs, the count was high, mm-hmm. right? Just as a recap for everybody, 100,000 jobs a month is just to sustain, you know, population growth, okay?
Yeah.
So what was that? Was that 250,000?
275,000.
275,000. That's a high number, so not something that the Fed wants to see. However, we had an uptick in unemployment.
3.7 to 3.9%.
Which is somewhat of a significant jump. Remember, unemployment. This is the first time unemployment has risen in 4 months, mm-hmm. and this is the highest unemployment has been in 2 years.
Now, for perspective, 5% is generally considered a healthy unemployment number.
Correct, yeah.
Now, once again, before I read the actual quote from the article, I think it's important to frame this in a way that contextualizes where we are today. So, number one, the Fed has now brought inflation down to sub 4%, frankly, into the 2% range.
Right.
Right? So now they've said their target range is 2 to 3% historically, but for whatever reason, Jerome Powell and this current FOMC has said that their target is going to be 2%. They have said they're going to be data dependent. They're going to rely heavy, heavy, heavy on the data and see that there's a continued progressive downward trend. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we've seen now jobs, while somewhat stagnant for the last 4 months, have now had an uptick from 3.7 to 3.9% in unemployment. Generally considered 5% shows healthy migration from job to job. And that'll really be the secondary driver outside of inflation for the Fed.
Right.
But you have a looming election. You've got two political parties which are very polarized. You can't be middle of the road anymore and be a middle of the road Democrat or Republican. You have to be an extremist to really engage your party and bring up that enough votes to really win.
Right.
So there's a lot of context that comes up and leads up to the November 5th elections. And I think that's important to keep as kind of a frame of reference. So here, data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics released Friday, and today we are recording this on the 11th of March, showed that the labor market added 275,000 non-farm payroll jobs in February, significantly more additions than the 200,000 expected by economists, as I alluded to earlier. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate has increased to 3.9% from 3.7% in January. This marks the first increase in the unemployment rate in 4 months, as it now sits at its highest level in the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, to again finish off the framing of the position that I think is important for the next article, You now have an environment where, like we've alluded to on previous shows, the Fed could, in theory, say, hey, fuck, man, we did a great job.
Pat on the back.
Neil Kashkari may have been drawn with crayons, but he wasn't wrong.
Yeah, you're not allowed into the room, Neil.
Yeah, you know what? You look good, bald.
Yeah, it's good.
But they could you know, do the whole wave the white flag. We surrender. We give up. Inflation. We're on the team. We're winning. We're good. You know.
Right.
Yeah. It's got Tiger. what is Charlie Sheen quote?
Tiger blood.
Tiger's blood. Yeah. Tiger's blood. Well, they're not, and they're still sticking this data dependency rhetoric. And a lot of people who criticized, I think one of the reels we put out saying that the Fed was positioned from a place of fear to make judgments.
Right.
They were saying, why do you think that? And I said, well, because you can't just unilaterally stop the decrease in inflation. You can't unilaterally stop the pressures downward.
Right.
Right. Think of what the Fed had to do in moving rates to get us from 9.1% down to where we are today.
Exactly.
It wasn't one Fed increase. It wasn't one 25 or 75 or even 100 basis point increase.
It wasn't the 7 that they had projected. It was 11.
Right. To get the cadence to move at the speed with which they wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
There is not going to be a single stopping point where they get it to stop moving.
Yes.
So they have already said they'd rather overcorrect and undercorrect. Overcorrecting means you're going to go from 2%, possibly below that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think in reality, there's some things that are going to happen which may give them a nice warning shot across the bow. So we talked on the last show about how shelter, episode 220, mm-hmm. about how shelter is a lagging indicator. And typically speaking, about every 6 months or so, you get an update that's pretty indicative of where the market's at.
Right.
Which explains why people are feeling differently for the rental market and for the housing market than what we're actually seeing in the numbers.
And that six-month period is because of how it gets reported in, not just because it takes every 6 months for prices to drop.
Exactly. So every 6 months or so, you see this data kind of coming in. Well, okay, if you get a good data point from the last 6 months or that aggregation that comes in, the Fed may be lucky enough to have that data point come in to send them to go, oh, okay, whoa. Because shelter has been the leading add to inflation.
Right.
If that pivots downward sharply, you could wind up at or below 2% inflation pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Which then, how do you stop inflation? Or how do you stop all these problems from continuing to decelerate and continuing to move downward?
Right.
Then you wind up in an economy where if you can't fix that inflation negative drop within 2 quarters, you are in recession territory. We have 2 negative quarters of GDP growth.
Right.
Because you're now in a deflationary economy.
Yes.
And therein lies the reason why we think that the Fed should come out and start cutting rates at least 25 basis points and kind of feel it out.
Exactly. So by when this episode drops, it'll be the 18th. So 2 days from then will be the next FOMC meeting, right? So yeah. The 20th,
yeah.
Right? It's expected that they're not going to do anything. Him and all the other Fed presidents have come out and said enough to where we now know, okay, we need more confidence. They can now rest on that. And they know that by not doing anything, it's not going to send shockwaves, you know, through the economy. But now it's looking more and more like May or June will be the first time we see a rate cut. Here's the good thing about this next meeting. We get our first summary of economic projections. So you remember, the last one we got was in December, where they lay out their projections of what it's going to look like for 2024. It'll be nice to see if those projections they had in December are the same for, you know, this coming March, if they still project 3 rate cuts by the end of the year, right? Because that's what they had projected in December.
I'd be stunned if they don't.
Right.
Now, keep in mind, those cuts can be anywhere from 25 basis points to 100 basis points or more, but I'd be stunned if they don't have 3. So to wrap up the context before we get into the next article, which I think is impactful and meaningful, and trust me, all this really matters for frame of reference, right? This is from Zero Hedge. This is a tweet. In the past month, the Biden administration, their department, of goal-seeking stuff higher before revising it lower has revised the following data sharply lower. So the prints came out and then were subsequently revised lower.
Okay.
Notably lower. The jobs reports.
Mm-hmm.
The JOLTS reports, which are effective jobs. New home sales. Housing starts and permits. Industrial production. PCE and core PCE.
All things making it seem like it's strong. So wait, core PCE came and reported higher?
Mm-hmm. And was revised lower.
Was revised lower. So if something like core PCE comes in higher, that allows the Fed to maintain their status quo and keep doing what they're doing, even though maybe they're hitting their target range or we're actually on that downward trend that they're looking for. Those jobs numbers that you referenced, or the JOLTS numbers, what does that do? Why do we need to cut the interest rates? We're still adding a lot of jobs every month. Job openings, there's still 2 jobs for every unemployed person. So all these things that are going against or actually helping the Fed maintain status quo are actually getting revised down.
So, exactly. And for context, about a month ago, and well, this is from Zero Hedge. This is the article titled, I just love it, "Inside the Most Ridiculous Jobs Report in History, Record 1.2 Million Immigrant Jobs Added in 1 Month." And just discard the immigrant connotation. It's not really super important to the data analysis here.
Okay.
The article starts off with this paragraph. "Last month, we, Zero Hedge, thought that January jobs reports was the most ridiculous in recent history." And they link back to the previous month's versions of it. "But boy, were we wrong."
Yeah.
"Because this morning, the Biden Department of Goal-Seeking Propaganda, a.k.a. the BLS, published a February jobs report. And holy crap, what was that?" It goes on. But look, I think there's a lot of political spin to this. One thing you can't deny, political or not, is that the Biden administration is the administration in charge and that these numbers are revised down. Those two things are facts. Now, whether they're related, there's manipulation there, I'll let you be the judge.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're the administration, you want the numbers to look good.
I mean, we can put our tinfoil hats on for a second and envision.
You look so good in a tinfoil hat.
So do you. I mean, that reel did really well with you having a tinfoil hat. So I can envision a world where there's propaganda out there being made,
mm-hmm,
to where if it was negative news coming out at a time like this, when people are out there, businesses are hurting and they need interest rates to get cut, right? If it was all this negative news coming out, it would cause hysteria, right?
True.
But if there's positive optimism, like, okay, you may be experiencing, you know, layoffs over here in this sector, right? Tech, you know, in the financial space, some banks are going down, whatnot. But look, there's 350,000 jobs being added. Unemployment is historically low.
Get the
low.
Fuck out of here. This is the part about America that blows me away. Okay?
And like the fact that people are buying into this bullshit bothers me.
You know how
me.
Many fucking people have laid people off recently?
Yeah.
Like, don't make me the asshole because I'm like, look, everybody's getting fucking laid off and you guys are like, oh, these numbers are coming out stronger than we expected. Holy shit.
Not to mention, go back at any time in history, unemployment peaks after a recession is declared over. So there's lag effects to this shit.
Yeah.
And how we're just going to ignore that fact?
I mean, totally ignore it.
That's coming.
Then, see, normally I wouldn't do the tinfoil hat presidential bullshit. I really wouldn't. I'm not that guy. But now I'm that guy.
You might have to be that guy.
I'm that guy now because that whole fucking bullshit after January 1st, 2022 through June 2022, the end of the month, right? Where in July they came out and said, no, not normally recession. It's normally recession of 2 quarters of negative GDP growth, but they also look at GDI and they threw out this whimsical, mm-hmm, bullshit definition.
Average the two, yeah.
Never before in history has the White House done some shit like that.
Right. Bullshit.
So, I mean, they went into this like game on, motherfucker. Strap up.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah, exactly.
Get the straps, boys. We're going in.
Mm-hmm. And then look what's going to happen. If they actually do start cutting rates in May or June, and somehow they're able to achieve this soft landing with numbers that who knows if they're accurate or not, if they're being fabricated, right?
Well, I've got some points on that I want you to consider, okay?
All right, let me hear it.
I like to think, as much as I make fun of people like Brian Moynihan, a CEO of Bank of America, that generally speaking, banks who look at this data to make sure their profitability is in line, they have departments which predict this for investment banking purposes, for their own, you know, forecasting and planning and budgeting.
Yeah, why? Why do they do that? Because they have to understand where their rates are going to be because they need to know when
it drives their profitability, man.
Right, and they got to know when they can come back into the market, right?
Banks are also sought after for their advice on other transactions. If their companies are merging, there's M&A groups, and especially the larger banks, the big globally systematic important banks. Banks are knee-deep in this shit. They employ some of the best economists in the world, right? And they consult with some of the best companies in the world for this, for themselves. So they're really in the center of this. And a lot of the greatest economists you've ever heard of work for banks or investment companies like, mm-hmm, PIMCO and Mohammed Al-Rayyan, stuff like that. But generally speaking, it's all in the same group. It's all nepotism-based. Everybody's, you know, in the same business, baby. We're all in the business of making money, okay? Right. On the surface, it almost appeared like another blockbuster jobs report. Certainly one which nobody expected, or rather just one bank out of 76 expected. Starting at the top, the BLS report that in February, the U.S. unexpectedly added 275K with just one research analyst from Dai-ichi Research. Dai-ichi Research, bro.
Come on,
that's
bro.
That's where we're at right now?
What is Dai-ichi Research?
Expected a higher number. And you know that guy was the guy who was high when he predicted it.
Expected, it's not that. Maybe
Kevin, what's the number? Oh, fuck, I shouldn't have done so much fucking mushrooms.
Dai-ichi Research.
Shit. 275?
Yeah, yeah. What is this? What are you coming up with? Justify it to me. How can you justify it when you know that January's jobs report is being revised down 100,000.
So the guy's name, the economist, was Seijai Katsurahata. It's Japanese, clearly. Dai-ichi Research Institute, yeah. He was talking about 286K jobs. Michael Reed at RBC Capital wanted 260K jobs. Ashworth and Dales over at Capital Economist North America Limited, 250K jobs.
Or they're just ahead of the game and they go, oh, the way these are being reported is such bullshit.
Richard Moody, Regions Bank, 249. Daniil something from University of Michigan, 245K.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody's even fucking close, man.
No way.
Yeah. Citigroup, 145K jobs. They were off a little bit.
So we'll see what happens. I mean, as of the day of this recording, like Chris said earlier, it's March 11th. Tomorrow CPI comes out. This is another data point that the Fed's going to look at for more confidence that inflation's headed in the right target.
Daddy's not done. He's got more on this.
Oh, you got more?
Oh, Daddy's going deep on jobs.
Let's go deep.
Yeah.
As deep as you can go.
Sometimes it's not about the depth. It's also about the breadth.
The breadth?
The girth, if you will, of the conversation. Because sometimes you need both in order to fully satisfy the intellectual need.
Understand.
Right?
All right.
I know that you're thinking about how wide the topic is, but I'm thinking about going a little longer. If you don't mind sparing the time.
Okay. Please do. Oh, wow. We're at 46
minutes. Do you think you can handle that?
I can handle it.
Okay. Before we go any further, I don't know why my mind works like this.
They've already, already fallen off, right?
And the sad part is, like, there's some kids going, Daddy, what is he saying?
Yeah, I know that they've got like 7-year-olds listening to the show.
I know, but they kudos to those parents. Hoping that it's lost on them.
Honestly, those are better parents than me.
I feel like we should be like the children's cartoon where there's adult jokes built into it too.
Yeah,
that not everybody in the room should get.
Right.
Right.
I mean, we need to say them and just gloss over. We don't need to like explain it.
It's hard for me to gloss over anything.
It's hard, isn't it?
I'm more like slap you in the face.
Would you let Carter listen to us?
When?
At 7.
At 7? No.
My wife will get in the car and it automatically start playing the podcast because she listens. And then the second she get out, she's heard us speak so many times, she'll just start to hear a topic on it and she's like, nope. She's so good. She cuts it off way early. I'm like, you're good. You don't even know where that was going.
Good for her. All right. So it appears the BLS read the comments from Zero Hedge and decided to stop making themselves at least a little bad. They did that by slashing the last month's ridiculous print by over a third. Mm. Okay. And revising what was originally reported as a massive 353,000 job beat to just 229,000 jobs.
Over 100,000.
124,000 revision, which was the biggest one-month negative revision in 2 years. Like, how is this all happening while you lead up to an election?
Right.
Right? I mean, this is bad. So, I'm just going to...
So, the way this happens, right, companies are supposed to report in. If they don't get their figures reported in soon enough, what happens is they make... the BLS makes an estimate, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you should be able to meet that expectation. And if you can't provide the number, you should be able to provide a rough estimate. That's going to be a lot closer than their rough estimate.
Well, plus they also include things like seasonal adjustments. They look at wages as a proxy.
Right.
They try to reverse engineer how some of things work. So I'll get to the creamy center of this Tootsie Pop. While the above data points were examples of some latent weaknesses in the latest reports, perhaps meant to give it a sheen of veracity, a look of truth, right? Cool. It was everything else in the report that was a problem, starting with the BLS's latest choice of seasonal adjustments after last month's wholesale revision, meaning well over 100,000. which have gone from merely laughable to full clown show. Mm. And anytime you get the expression full clown show in a financial analytics like review,
right?
Like you're doing something right. Right? Yeah, I mean, like,
exactly.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Kudos.
I never got to use that in anything professional that ever said. Right. You know what, America? This is a full clown show. As the following comparison between the monthly change in BLS and the ADP payroll shows. So I have never liked independent private company ADP payroll like disclosures because it's complete bullshit. And right. I know people who worked at ADP who are responsible for this.
Oh, really?
And they've literally told me like, their fucking numbers are horseshit.
Wow.
Yeah, that's from people inside the company.
But they're more conservative than what the non-farm payrolls are, right?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no.
Okay.
The trend is clear. The Biden admin numbers are now clearly rising, even as the impartial ADP, which directly logs employment numbers at the company level and is far more accurate, shows an accelerating slowdown. And it should.
Right.
How many fucking companies have you heard about laying off recently?
Yeah, exactly.
A lot.
Exactly. So that's another thing to keep in mind. What some of the numbers are really alluding to is that you're getting a lot of people that are getting hired as part-time employees. You're not getting full-time jobs as much anymore. Wage growth is not going up and keeping up with inflation as like it was before either. So these are all things you got to keep in mind.
So I will make sure, as we always do, to quote this article's link in the show notes. It is a much broader analysis than we've actually spoken about right now mm-hmm. for context of revision. I think it's worthwhile. If you have any interest in this topic and you really want to know how the jobs report is calculated, that is a great chart-by-chart breakdown of the underlying assumptions. While they're being very critical of the Biden administration and the assumptions that are in place, I think there's a lot of value in understanding it. So just food for thought. If you want some homework from the show, we'll be checking you next week for a grade, kids, and everybody gets the D.
Right. Everybody gets the D. So with wage growth coming in just a little bit lower on the month-to-month figure, the unemployment number increasing from 3.7 to 3.9%, you got that downward revision of 124,000 that Chris just mentioned. If you're looking for a rate cut sooner rather than later, which we all are, this is headed in the right direction. This is one of those good data points that have come out before the Fed meeting. Now, you're not going to get it in March.
No.
But you might get it in May. Maybe. I mean, that's the earliest if we're lucky. I'm still leaning closer to June.
You think somebody at the FOMC has heard this podcast by now and gone like, these motherfuckers.
Dude, with some of the reels that we've been putting out, there's no way somebody hasn't shared with them like, dude, these guys are really fucking with you, Jerome.
Yeah, you know what? And here's a problem, too, is I keep posting stuff, and I've intentionally not posted one where we talked about Neil Kashkari on LinkedIn because, again, we're connected.
Yeah.
But I know he's been scrolling late at night and going, what the fuck?
What are these guys doing over there?
Yeah.
Who are these guys?
And I'm also hesitating because I started working on a reel tonight.
Okay.
Before I came to the show, I had like, 30 minutes. I was going to bang one out. Mm-hmm. And I got it largely done. But it's all you again. And I'm like, I know this one's going to go viral.
All me again?
I know it's going to go viral. All I got to do is put a dollar bill behind him and give him a sensational title. And it's off to the moon again.
Off to the moon. Let's go, baby. Meanwhile, TikTok about to get banned.
Hey, man. I could not be happier for it.
Honestly.
I'm all in.
Hurry up and get this shit done.
Send me the petition, America. I'll sign it right now.
Bro, unanimous vote is crazy.
People are like, Chris, are you a hater about TikTok? Yes.
Yeah, all the way.
All the way a hater. Straight hater.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah. I've been drinking a Haterade. I now feel like I'm fully hydrated on the Haterade.
Right.
And now I can piss Haterade.
Right. And I'm on my way to my Hatercation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All hate all day, baby.
Let's go. Fuck out of here, man. I'm tired of this shit.
K-Hate. It's the best radio station out there. I'm fucking so tired of TikTok. It pisses me off. Like, there's a couple things that piss me off about TikTok. A couple things I love. Number one, I was a big proponent of TikTok when I got used to it when it came out. Like, after I got over the whole like stigma during the pandemic, I was like, okay, I get this now, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a moment where it was pure. And then you start reading the terms agreements and all this other shit. And then you start figuring out like what they have access to, including like your facial stuff and your biometrics. I mean, it's wild. They can look at your keystrokes on your phone, even that are the keystrokes that are not involving the app.
Right.
I mean, shit's wild. If you read the actual user agreement, which I have gone down the rabbit hole and done because I'm an idiot.
Right.
Right. It is wide what they allow you to do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what they have them to do,
and what they have access to, it's absolutely crazy. So for the listeners out there that don't know what's going on with this, there's a bill that's being presented in front of Congress that they're going to be voting on fairly soon. I can't remember if it was in front of the House. I think it was in front of the House that they voted on, right? Or was it in front of the Senate where it passed unanimously, bipartisan, both sides were like, yeah, shut this shit down, get it out.
And Biden's already said he'll sign it when it gets to him. He's like, when it gets here, just know it's going right through.
Yeah, right.
It's going diarrhea.
Right. And then, I forget. They had a spokesperson. I don't know what his position was that was actually speaking in front of Congress.
Oh, that dude from Singapore was fucking articulate and clear.
Yeah, he was articulate.
He was good, dude. Say what you want. That fucking guy came ready.
But he was citing all kinds of shit in there. Some of the shit that he was saying was making me laugh so hard, even though he was as serious as can be. Yeah. He's like, what do you mean? This is not completely China-based. We got people from Australia working at our company. You're like, why you gotta bring Australia into this? Like,
no,
that's the vote of confidence? We got Australia. Y'all ain't cool with Australia?
So here's the thing is, if China wasn't so nefarious,
yeah,
he was well prepared.
He was. They said they got several Americans that are on their board.
Yeah, no, he was well prepared. He certainly knew what he was talking about. He was articulate. He responded well under pressure, and the pressure was heightened.
Yeah.
But here's the problem, and I mean this with no disrespect. Most of your politicians are fucking morons, right? They were asking him questions just to get answers from him that they just wanted a soundbite. Yeah. But they didn't care. Nothing he said was going to change their perspective.
I mean, a lot of them are attorneys, aren't they? Or not a lot of them, but some of them definitely, right?
Let me just put it this way. I'm an attorney, so the bar is low.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
It's
yeah.
not a high bar.
Got you.
It's a very low bar.
Got you. Okay.
But, yeah, man. I don't think he had a shot in hell, even as articulate and as educated as he sounded on the topics. And he did a far better job than anybody else out there. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it mattered what he said. But what I will say about TikTok is they open up a TikTok shop. Now they're trying to sell products through, like, so everybody's now pimping content, and there's a link directly to the product. They're pimping you now.
Oh, right.
So anybody can say, I'm using a product. You can buy from the TikTok shop, and they get a referral
link.
That
was supposed to take some of the market share away from Amazon?
Yeah. Which, okay, fine. But it's now made this what was otherwise a pure experience, very salesy, right? There are some people who blew up during the pandemic who honestly, I think, have now really abused the audience concept. Mm. A lot of people in the entrepreneur bro space.
Yes.
And there's so many their names I can literally drop right now. I'm like, okay, this was everything that was wrong with NFTs. Everything that was wrong with some of the stuff that was happening. Mm-hmm. I think I would love to see those people deplatformed.
Yeah.
And a lot of them had a tough time growing on Instagram. You want to know why? Because you fucking suck, dude.
But they were able to make it on YouTube, unfortunately.
Yeah, a lot of people were able to cross-pollinate their brands and cross-promote them. And good for them. But I would love to see some people deplatformed for TikTok going away, mm-hmm. and we get back to the problem is too is you have Instagram, which is very political too. There's a lot of woke culture stuff that happens there,
right?
And this is where like I go back and forth. Like I love the idea that like X is out there and you can say whatever you want, but I also don't like the idea that I could inevitably scroll my way into porn.
Yeah,
like I like to be deliberate about my porn.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's a mental space you have to get into before you could actually.
If I'm not ready for it and you hit me with it, it's just like, why?
Yeah,
ah.
Right, exactly. It's you don't just, know where I am. You don't know where I'm looking
at. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to go to the bathroom, dude. comes up.
You might be in a meeting.
Yeah, I don't want that.
Yeah, you need that alert, that not safe for work alert. Come on.
Yeah. There is a way to like, and I have it on where it like blocks like the content.
Yeah.
But then you get like this like image that says it's inappropriate, and then you got to know why it's inappropriate.
But like on a serious note, when I started hearing about how the algorithm is different for us being the U.S. versus China, especially for the kids, mm-hmm. right? Like the kids are limited, and then their ads are more like educational games that they have to play, mm-hmm. and more educational content is geared towards them. You're like, wait a minute, this is a wild long play that they're trying to make that to really hurt an entire generation of kids.
Yeah, but this goes back to the Cold War era Russia, where they tried to infiltrate the American culture and with spies. And we thought the spies were about gathering information and intel. What we didn't understand during that period of time was the spies were also about disseminating propaganda into the space vis-a-vis the younger, more susceptible generation. Mm. Now, flash forward that same program decades later, and what do you have? You have school teachers on campuses taking young minds and now shaping them in a way where they're actually working against the U.S. political system because they're pushing out against it.
Right.
Think about something as simple as the concept of, let me think of something that's not super inflammatory, the Wonderless Life, right?
What's that? I don't know what that is.
Just getting into a van and driving around, being completely detached.
Van life, right.
You know, you can't make it in America, kids. Mm-hmm. So you shouldn't try.
Right.
You're effectively breaking up the monopoly that is America that was based on capitalism by having people opt out on some level, right? Mm-hmm. And you're kind of changing the paradigm. But you could also do things like have people using woke culture have a very divided internal culture. because people are now focusing on these other tertiary fights. They're not focusing on the bigger picture.
Right.
You're dividing and conquering the country.
Well, yeah, there was that. And I think there was a report that came out a couple years back where they found that 19 out of the top 20 church Facebook pages.
Oh, yeah. Rogan talks about that.
Yeah, always talks about it. That were really Russian bots. And you're like, that's that Russian propaganda stuff that you were just talking about getting spread. And you're like, wait a minute. And then they'll find a way to like sprinkle in some like political agenda. And you're just like, what the fuck, man?
One of the number one things that people went volatile. So somebody asked me what are common scams that people fall for. And I said, Amazon's e-commerce stores.
What do you mean Amazon e-commerce stores?
So anybody who's selling you give me 25 grand. I'll set up an e-commerce store for you to sell your product. Man. That happens all the time.
It's so easy. All you got to do is get these affiliate links.
Yeah, and the products always get shut. The stores always get shut down. The products never get out. You know, it's a whole fucking thing. I said a lot of the fitness influencer space, like nutrition plans, is scams. You got to learn how to do it yourself. You got to understand macros and do it yourself. All they're doing is running you through a macro calculator and giving it to you. And 9 times out of 10, it's not them. It's a third-party company that they're private labeling, white labeling to sell to you.
Yeah, instead of paying that money to that fitness coach, you could literally pay for, a food delivery service to...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And you still got to figure out your macros. The problem is there's no shortcuts to you doing the hard work, and that's what all these things try to do. Like, people who sell courses online, generally speaking, unless there's somebody who's really worthy of teaching a master class... Like, Bob Iger says, I'm teaching a master class. Okay, I'll pay for that.
Yeah, right.
You know, you got a track record.
Casey Neistat saying he's going to teach you how to make a film.
Yeah, right? Pay for that.
Yeah, worth paying for.
Okay, some guy sitting in front of a Lamborghini who says that he's made millions and he owns a 7-figure business. No, absolutely not.
No.
No.
Right.
Or somebody saying I run a 7-figure company. Okay, first of all, what does that mean? Is it worth 7 figures?
Right.
If you're in 7 figures in top line sales, bottom line sales, is it gross, net? What are you talking about here?
Right.
Like, I mean, there's so many things. But one of the things I threw in there was religion. Top scams in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And people lost their fucking mind.
By the way, Ramadan Mubarak to all the listeners out there.
Oh, yeah. Coming up, right?
Oh, today.
Today was today?
Day one.
Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. Fasting?
No.
Aww.
Didn't do it today, no.
What's that?
I'll be honest. I forgot that it was day one. I'm just going to be honest. I'm going to give it a go tomorrow, though.
Are you really? Why? You forgot already day one. You're already going to hell.
No, it's not. Come on.
I mean, that's the progression here, right?
He's going to forgive me.
It's like good hell. Good, bad.
It was so bad. I literally took the kids to school today, and I was chewing some gum, and I ran into a family who was also Muslim, and they greeted me with Ramadan Mubarak, and I was like chewing gum. I'm like, ah, shit. Missed day one. My bad, yo. I'm going to try tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, I felt like a real piece of shit, but yeah, we're going to set up the whole, we're going to set up an Eid tree and everything. That's our family tradition.
Oh, Eid. Eid.
Eid tree. We do, instead of doing a Christmas tree every year, we have a tree that we do for Eid, and we put presents under it so they get the same feeling. They don't feel left out.
I'm not going to judge you.
Don't judge me.
I'm going to take the higher road, the road less traveled by. I have one more set of jobs numbers from my favorite X page.
One more jobs numbers. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I do. I had like a lot of content.
All the jobs.
Yeah, I told you, I wanted to spend some time in the jobs.
Okay.
Deep in there.
All right.
Docking it.
Docking. Shout out to the old OG listeners.
Shout out to the Mormons. All right. So the Kibisi letter. I knew it was going to be a good tweet. Or is what? How do you say tweet?
Yeah, it's a good X.
Is it a good X?
It's a tweet.
A good exchange?
Listen, Elon, we love you. It's still tweet, okay?
Just give me the vernacular I'm supposed to be using so I don't sound like a jackass.
Yeah, but you can't. You're changing like cult. He messed up the culture, man.
Like, I'm okay if it's not tweeting anymore. Just tell me what it's supposed to be. I'm Xing. X gonna give it to you. That's something.
Xing sounds like a lot like scissoring. You can't be doing, it's like.
Oh, I don't do that. You might.
No, not me.
You sure there? Start off with wow. All the headlines will show that the U.S. economy added 275,000 jobs in February. But in reality, the number of people actually employed fell by about 184,000, according to Zero Hedge. It's been revised since the first article came out.
Right.
The number of workers employed in the U.S. was 160.968 million, the lowest number since May of 2023.
Interesting.
Yeah. Little fun fact that the BLS isn't sharing with you. So how did the numbers of people employed fall while the U.S. economy added jobs?
Valid point. I mean,
That's just plus minus.
Yeah, it's just math.
You can do this on an abacus in Rome, okay? right?
That's a good point. Can you repeat that again? That was so good.
Yeah, I'm throwing this out there. So how did the number of people employed fall while the U.S. economy added jobs? I'm just saying, there's a problem there.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but apparently it makes dollars.
Right.
The answer to this question is the rapid increase in workers holding, are you ready for it?
Mm.
More than one job.
Oh. Yeah, because, well.
Hey, meow.
Hey, now, come on
come
now.
Come on, man. Give me my credit.
Come on now.
We talked about the paradigm shift on the show several shows ago. We said at one point in time, you could live at a single employed, one worker household. Mm-hmm. Then you had to have a two-income household. You had to do that to survive. And I've been telling people, the side hustle is a real problem.
Right.
So again, the answer to this question is the rapid increase in workers holding more than one job, which means people are literally working two fucking jobs.
They need to in order to stay afloat.
I've been telling people this is a paradigm shift. The numbers are not capturing. In fact, 278,000 Americans took on more than one job in February. 278,000.
Goddamn. So what are your thoughts on this? This is as an executive at a company, right? This is really hard for this is
bro. You're gonna put me in a fucked up situation. That's the problem. You're baiting me right now.
I ain't baiting you.
This is some shit where you're like, nah. Should I edit that out? No, nah. Leave it in there.
All right, maybe we don't get into it.
No, I'll give you my thoughts in a second. Let me finish this. All while the January jobs report was revised lower by 129,000 jobs, as seen in 10 of the last 12 months. Is the labor market really that strong? No, it is not.
No, it's not that strong. Yeah. It's gonna get worse before it gets better. So here's the question. Question is,
and I got a great example from today to answer this question with, by the way.
Okay, but now do you think it's a blanket answer where every, like, it's gonna answer, are you saying it's the same case for everybody? Because what if there's a situation where somebody is able to manage two jobs at once and they never miss a meeting, they never miss an assignment, they hit every detail, they're there, you know, obviously their time is split, but however they're meeting their deadlines.
There are some people that are capable of doing that. That's why so many people are hidden in the numbers there.
Right.
Right? But I think that has a couple different implications. Number one, the way we calculate jobs should change. If that is reflective of how jobs are being indicated.
But they're not telling their employer that, yo, I got this other job on the side.
Again, then we need to change the way we report numbers, and employees need to get comfortable with it or they don't.
Because people are actually relying on these figures.
Right. But this problem, frankly, has lasted for a long time, and it's been around in different forms. You could easily be a consultant and do these things totally legally. Nobody cares what time you're working if you're a consultant. Mm-hmm. But there are benefits to being a W-2 employee that you get for a full-time job that you don't get as a consultant, i.e. healthcare, right. i.e. 401k access, things like that. I think if you were more transparent with your company, some companies would be like, fuck you, you're out, we don't want to deal with it. But eventually, over time, if enough people were transparent that they need to do this, the company could say, okay, look. If you're going to commit that you're going to work for us and us only during these hours of the day, right? Then, hey.
But you know that's not how it's going to work. That's not how it's working.
Well, and that's the problem is there's so many people who are working untraditional hours now.
So it's like, okay, that's why they're making people return back to the office?
No, I think the problem is what I experienced today. I'm not going to name anybody. And I don't think this person was doing anything wrong. But I took today off to spend the day with my son.
Mm.
He asked me last night, first time he ever asked me to do that. And I was like, yep. Say less.
Love that.
So I walked with him down to the Starbucks by our house and then walked back up to the park, which is right next to our house. Mm-hmm. Got him a cake pop, which he didn't want because daddy, I need to have lunch first. Otherwise, mommy's going to get mad. And I'm like, mommy doesn't need to know. He's like, yes, she does.
Damn, son.
I was like, damn, bro.
Got brainwashed already?
Whipped. That boy whipped.
Yeah, come back to me in a couple of years.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this problem when you start dating, boy. And I walk into the coffee shop and there's a coworker there. She was pleasant. She was nice. And she felt compelled to tell me that she took the day off so she can go get her hair done and stuff like that.
100%. You got to. I mean, that'd be kind of awkward.
But it's more stigmatized now because people are like, whoa, aren't you supposed to be working? Because you can work from home.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally speaking, if I saw you out and you weren't like at a coffee shop near the office and you're like, oh, I'm just hopping to grab a drink, I'm going back to the office. If I saw you out, we would both think that you were off or you weren't working that day. But because you can work from home, because you do have more flexibility, so much of this is changing to where, but it's still uncomfortable culturally.
Yes.
Right? Like, you don't want anybody to like think one thing, another thing, whatever, right? So it's very, very weird. And I don't think the business world's figured out a solution yet, us included. Like, you want people to be in the building and to build rapport and establish rapport with one another.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if someone can do two jobs, who am I? Here's the problem that I really struggle with. It's not the way you've coined it. I'll give you a different example. And I've long been a proponent of, it's not what you do between 9 to 5, it's what you do between 5 and 9 that's going to make you the money.
Yes.
But when you think about that, what I'm really telling you is I'm working a second job. It's just my second job is investing in my own growth.
Right.
Either personally, educationally, or financially in investments that I'm making outside of those traditional business hours, right?
Right.
But if you can do that, one inside a normal scope of 8 hours and one outside, at some point in time with the autonomy and flexibility that we have, those worlds collide. Mm-hmm. And it winds up being a little bit of that 5 to 9 in your 9 to 5 because you need to have a phone call at lunch. You need to have a phone call or meetings, just, you know, whatever it is, right?
It's going to get intertwined.
So at what point in time are you able to control that ecosystem? And I don't think the answer is I think over time, people want more autonomy. They don't want to be dedicated to companies because they don't feel the companies are loyal to them anymore.
Right.
There's so few pensions out there.
Because that's how they're starting to feel, right? It's like that at-will employment, right? The company, especially with the layoffs that we've seen, employees are starting to feel like, well, man, they're just going to get rid of me. So, like, I might as well take care of me before I ever take care of them.
And right now, with unemployment being so low, the odds of you getting the job are pretty high. If only 4% of America,
if you believe in these numbers, yeah.
Yeah,
it depends on the sector, right? Like, it's going to be hard, like, for someone in our space, you know, certain departments, if you get let go, then I don't know how many other institutions like us are going to be hiring because it's tight for everybody.
It is, but, you know, I look at all this stuff and I think to myself that the way we think about the American worker really needs to change. When you go back to the Industrial Revolution, these families that were the architects and the original input to the White House and the administration on what they needed from their workers, which really developed the educational system and subsequently developed a little bit of the worker system, was they wanted people that were loyal and committed. But in return for those things, in middle class, you were guaranteed to be able to buy a home and have a nice life, buy a nice car and have, you know, good things. You didn't have to have a two-person employed household. You could do it with one single income. You could have 2-3 kids in enough space in a house at the time that was, you know, we talked about wage inflation versus housing inflation. You got pensions, lifetime payment after you left the company. You got lifetime coverage of health care. So many things that were guaranteed are such rare anomalies now. And we've streamlined what American workers think they can and should get. At what point in time does American workers say, I deserve more and you deserve less?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the pandemic showed that. It changed things. To this day, I want to say it's like 28% of people are still working remote.
Oh, yeah, somewhere around there.
But
I think a hybrid schedule is probably the way.
Yeah, so if you layer in hybrid on top of that 28%, that's a lot of office space that doesn't need to be utilized anymore, mm-hmm. right?
But what do you do with it? Not everything can get converted.
And if you're hybrid, you're still using it. You're just not using it all the time.
Correct.
So it winds up being a very difficult cultural change and a very difficult time in American culture. And I think that we're going to have to see more changes over time. We're still filling out what that is. A lot of CEOs, a lot of companies are going to try to get back to what it was. Mm-hmm. I don't think you ever get there. I think over time, people start to pull back more and more, and it winds up being a very different lifestyle.
Yeah, I agree. Before we wrap up this show, we had one comment from episode 219 that somebody left that I thought was worth reading, and I'd like for you to get...
I didn't realize you actually looked at social media comments anymore.
What do you mean?
I thought that was beneath you.
Beneath me?
Yeah, doesn't your wife reply to those for you?
No, stop it. This is from our Hack Your Mortgage episode from Jose Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I love the podcast and thank you for all the great info delivered in an easy to understand way. Also, you guys are hilarious.
Oh, well, thank you, Jose.
Yeah, thank you, Jose. We appreciate you.
I think you mean me, but Sai does laugh at my jokes as well.
Yeah. I'm a little upset that my viral TikTok video might be going away. I need a screenshot of that before.
Oh, is that why you're so sensitive about it? I'm happy to have that fucking thing go away.
All right. Now on the video topic, we recently got married. Congratulations.
Yeah, good for you.
And bought our first home in August of 2023. Mm. Wow. Our real estate agent, who is phenomenal on many fronts, suggested we make an extra mortgage payment each year. Right?
Yeah. Again, that depends on your lender, if they're willing to accept it and if they apply it towards principal only. Or if they apply it towards principal and interest, you got to communicate with your lender on that kind of stuff.
Right. And when you do, if they do allow for both, you need to be very clear that you want this payment to go straight to principal.
Correct.
Right. From my understanding, this is very similar to making bi-weekly payments on your mortgage. My question is, what is the difference in making the bi-weekly payment versus simply making an extra mortgage payment at the end of the year from purchase of the home? Is there a benefit saving more on interest paid to making bi-weekly payments versus an extra payment?
So to be clear here, there's actually two different types of bi-weekly payments. What we talked about in episode 219 is literally paying your mortgage every other week.
Right.
Right. So if you owe $2,600 every single month for your mortgage, you pay $1,300 one week, and then 2 weeks later, you pay another $1,300 for your total payment.
Right.
Now, you have to get approval from your lender in advance to get that done, and a lot of them won't do it. Mm-hmm. They just won't do it.
And the way that works out is just if you do it every 2 weeks, you got to think how many weeks are there in a year. That just works out to more payments towards mm-hmm. your mortgage, right, every single year.
Right, and some of them will take it and apply it all towards principal, right? So all towards interest. And then you'll have some remaining principal at the end. So it's not super effective. You want to find one that applies it, you know, in some way where it's partially towards principal and partially towards interest as
right.
well. Now, is it going to be as beneficial or as good if you pay once at the end of the year one other payment? No. You're carrying interest for longer over time.
Yes.
So ideally, in theory, right, your principal balance, when you get a loan, you pay mostly interest in the beginning and very little principal. And over time, it basically switches. Mm-hmm. Gradually over time, it literally just kind of gets this inflection point and it switches and you're paying mostly principal and less interest. And towards the end of your mortgage, you're paying almost entirely principal and very little interest.
Right, because the bank wants to make sure, the lender wants to make sure they're getting their profits up front.
Yeah. And in doing so, you wind up paying less interest over time by paying down interest in a truly bi-weekly payment plan than you do if you're paying at the end of the year one time and just reducing your principal that one period in the year, as opposed to reducing the interest a little bit, or reducing the principal and subsequently your interest every single time you make a payment throughout the year.
Right. Yep. Exactly. So,
but there is, just to be clear, if you pay once a year an extra payment, that's still a very good thing to do. Mostly 99% of America's not doing that.
Right.
So don't be discouraged. And if your lender will allow that and not allow the biweekly payments, which, by the way, is a lot more probable, mm-hmm. then just do that. Yeah, fine.
Right.
And still saving tons of money.
And for someone like Jose and his partner, what I would say is it makes a little bit more sense for someone in their position because they just purchased the home in August of 2023. Mm-hmm. The rate, their interest rate on their loan, right, you're effectively getting that kind of return when you make that payment, right? You're getting a return of, what, 6.5%, maybe 7%.
Which you otherwise would not have spent, yeah.
Right, but if – and also you have to factor in, is this really a home I envision myself being in for over 6, 7, 8 years, because you want that equity appreciation over time, right? If you don't know if you're going to stay here for the next 5 years or not, maybe your money is better served somewhere else.
It could be, but for most people, I think paying the extra money – if you have it and you budget for it accordingly and it's not going to hurt you or strain you, then I think that's probably the best way to go.
Awesome. All right. Well, you got anything else, Odin?
Ooh, yeah.
Stinky Pinky.
He's like, can I come in? I'm like, are you going to be touching the controls? He goes, yeah. I'm like, no.
He's like, no, guys, you cannot. I'm not showing any symptoms.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, you are. You're very close to the symptoms, though.
Yeah, you're very close to the symptoms. And let's be honest. He's always hacking up back there. You don't know if he's sick.
I don't hear it. You hear it.
I do every time I edit. Although the last show was very minimal.
Really?
Yeah. Very, very minimal. I'm pretty sure he was doing something back there.
You know, no, it was because you kept bringing him in. Like, what are you doing? He kept talking. So he didn't have to keep clearing his throat. Mm. That's what we need to do. We need to find ways to loop him in.
Oh, and he didn't have a monster.
Oh, he didn't. You're right.
He did not have a monster. And there was notably less coughing back there. Mm. Yeah. All right.
A little trial and error run. All right, you got anything else?
No, that's it.
Appreciate you, brother.
Appreciate you.
It was nice. It was like old times.
Yeah, no, it was like two of America's most wanted. Yeah. Arun, you're fired.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.